Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of our second Real Estate Insights Earth series, exploring the role and responsibilities of the property sector in the future sustainability of our planet and lives. I'm Guy Ruddle.
And I'm Marilis Ramos.
So far we've explored things like what it takes to be investor ready when it comes to ESG and the challenges facing the national grid.
And today we're going to look at impact investing and how environmental economics can be used to put an actual value on impact.
And as usual, we've scoured our less than healthy planet to find the finest minds in the area. Let's start with Tom Hill, who heads up Savills Impact Advisory Team. Hello, Tom. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
What does heading up the Impact Advisory Team mean?
So what we do is we help, we work with organisations and public private sector to look at their total impact. And so what we do is help them to look at their environmental, social and economic impact and then compare that to their financial performance.
And we also have Sarah Jackson, who heads up Savills' Rural Consultancy. Welcome to the podcast, Sarah.
Hello.
So how does ESG affect the work that you do day to day?
Well, I'm incredibly lucky because I'm a valuer in Scotland. And so I spend a huge amount of time looking after clients' property in Scotland, valuing property in Scotland. And so what I've seen in Scotland over the last few years is this exponential rise as ESG has come to the fore.
So time and time again, when you're valuing property, people are saying, you know, what should I be doing? How should I be thinking about this sort of thing?
Yes, there's a fundamental shift in the way that property has been looked at and valued in Scotland, especially the uplands.
Oh, okay. And our last guest is Henry Le Fleming, who is the founder of Sustainability Analytics, through which he helps senior management teams develop business cases and investment theses around sustainability. Henry, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
And how long ago did you set up Sustainability Analytics?
It's been about since 2020, so just before COVID times hit us, and been working with various companies since then.
Well, let's get stuck into this then. So we talked about ESG investing a few episodes ago, and now we're talking about impact investing. Tom, what's the difference?
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of overlaps between the two. And generally speaking, ESG investing is largely focused on how can the world have a sort of bad impact upon your business. And so it often takes a sort of risk or checklist type approach, and you're looking to basically weed out governance issues or social impacts that could undermine investor confidence in your business. Impact investing is the other way around. It's actually focused on how does your business have an impact in the world. So it's the other way of looking at it. And often there you're looking at what benefits or costs to society are associated with the activities that the business does.
So, Sarah, how does this relate to the process of valuation?
Well, in the rural world, the driver for buying farms and estates has long been detached from entirely economic or fiscal reasons. And so our buyers, both owner-occupiers and investors, have always had to consider sort of the social and environmental aspects of what they're buying. This isn't an investment that just gets cash at the end of the day. There are staff, there are people on the ground. And so our rural markets have to flex with that as people come into the market.
Henry, I'm sort of getting the impression that ESG is more about defensive, you're being defensive and protecting yourself, and impact is more proactive. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the other element to it is that impact investing is also going to try and look at the scale of the different elements within the framework that you're applying to the business. And that gives you an opportunity to then make trade-offs between different parts of it and look where you're causing good things happen within society, but also comparing that to the scale of the bad things, the pollution or other impacts you're having on society. Whereas ESG is a little bit more of a, as Tom said, a checklist going through, saying this, this and this, without really being able to look at the different weights between those elements of it. So, it's both positive and also enables that comparison as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So before we go into it, maybe you should approach this via some of the rules and regulations, taking a step back. What are and how important are things like SFDR, which are the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulations, the CSRD, lots of alphabet soup here, Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, and the TNFD, which is the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosure?
I mean, all of those things are going to bring a framework to help companies or investors or landowners to look at these things. and they're useful in terms of that framework as far as it goes. But often the final step that tells companies or investors exactly what they've got to measure and exactly what they've got to do for impact investing is really still a bit of a blank page. So the frameworks are useful. They take you there. They take you where impact investing might take you. But they're not going to give you the things you need to measure and how you need to measure them. So, yeah, useful framework, scaffolding, helping there, but not the building that you're building at the end of the day.
But that's good, though, because there's a lot of creativity and flexibility built into that.
Yeah, and I think it's very difficult to regulate where you don't know exactly what you want those companies or those investors to do.
Yeah, what I'd also say is that by its very nature, impact investing is often operating on the vanguard of investment. So it's always pushing the boundaries, and that applies both in terms of the types of investments that people are looking at. So some of the best performing ones are, say, renewable technologies and so on, but also in types of the techniques in which you're actually using to analyse those. It's often sort of cutting edge. And so you're always looking at the sort of leaders within the sector in order to take it forward.
All these, as Mary Liz said, acronyms, you know, lots of an alphabet soup of letters. Does that put people in the rural world off, or the opposite?
I think many of my clients, we've lived with it for a long, long time in order to achieve basic payment. In terms of the TCFD, TNFD, it feels a long, long way away from our farmers. But ultimately, if these organisations who have to report within these frameworks, they're going to have to work with their primary producers. The primary producers are at one part of the chain. So whether that's farmers or land managers or foresters, that information is needed to fulfil this corporate reporting, and it is inevitable.
Yeah, I think a lot of these frameworks and standards are aimed at large organisations. And as Sarah says, there's a sort of feeding down there, but a lot of the burden associated with these sort of compliance and reporting at the high level, and they tend to have more resources to be able to deal with that type of expectation.
Yeah, I wonder whether to a certain extent, you know, you can't, this is, we're talking today about impact investing and the people who are doing the investing, right? They can't really do that without at least some sort of framework, can they?
Yeah, I mean, they need a framework, and that's where kind of SFDR or the EU taxonomy comes in. So they give you a framework. But what they tend to do now is they tend to leave a space at the end of it, which says you need to report each year to the fund authority in your where your fund is registered. So they're going to give you that, but they don't specify exactly what you've got to report. They just give you, as I said before, the scaffold to help you do it, and then say, okay, what do you report? And you end up sat there going, what do I report under this framework to prove that I'm Article 9 or Article 8 under that EU taxonomy or the emerging regulations in the UK? So there's still space there to look at it, and I think it's an opportunity as much as it is a difficulty. Because if you're a company, you have a specific, you can identify a specific purpose you're going to work towards, whether it's running agricultural businesses, farming, or being a retailer that does things very well and getting that food right. It gives you space to define how you want to make the impact on society from your company work. So you can't specify all these things to the last detail. There's a little bit of openness there that you need to be able to be creative and be able to have that kind of connection to the stakeholders, but also consumers and all the rest of it as well.
Well, in terms of just the basic attitude towards impact investing, it all sounds great. It all sounds like it's going to have a huge impact. Is it moving towards that? Are more people doing this? Is it going to be the future?
Yeah, so there's a sort of international industry body for impact investing. It's called the Impact Investing Institute.
And it that's a new one on me.
Yeah, and it reckons that that the market for impact investing has grown to $1.2 trillion as of 2023, I think. So it's grown, and it's been growing very fast year on year. And I think what's driving that is a sense that under some of the sort of traditional forms of considering ESG, you're getting a lot of companies that people don't necessarily perceive to be that environmental, coming up well on the metrics. Whereas with impact investing, the focus is explicitly on what the benefits are being created. And because of that, it seems to chime more with people's understanding of what an ethical investment should be.
So let's talk a little bit about the practicalities of this and what actually impact investing is, and or examples of where it is. And Sarah, we'll come on to urban later, but for now, rural. What does it actually mean? What does it actually do?
Well, I think what I can talk about is what has happened in Scotland. So where I work, what has changed recently? And Scotland has scale. If anyone who's been, you can acquire huge tracts of land, and therefore your impact in what you're doing can be significant. And so what we've seen over the last few years is some people investing in the land market in Scotland that wouldn't necessarily have been there before. So some very well publicised examples include BrewDog, who bought the Lost Forest or Kinrara estate. So that was just over 9,000 acres of what was a sporting estate. And they're now doing a huge amount of planting and peatland restoration. We have Oxygen, who bought Langham. We have Aviva and Par Equity, who bought Glendie. And this is all people who are looking at the peatland carbon code and the woodland carbon code as both fiscal and also environmental and social benefits.
I think that was exactly right. I think what you're talking about there is the activities you're looking to do, and then there's some measurement that goes with those activities, right? So the impact investment is both the choice, but then the bits we've just been talking about, the reporting, the need to report on these things, getting understanding of those other activities and reporting some of those things. So the peatland carbon or the woodland carbon, and then further activities to change biodiversity, for example, which happens in other parts of the UK as well. So it's both the decision on where you take the land and then what you report on and what you talk about as well, I think.
Yeah, as anyone who listens to Real Estate Insights will know, I'm a bear of very little brain, so I need this explaining to me a bit more. All those people, are they investing in land to make money out of that land or just to have an impact and offset that against other stuff they're doing, or is it part of their core operations?
Land is not an easy asset to own, and what they're doing is stacking. So I think there's multiple benefits to them for having this. Land is a long-term play. It's not about a short-term gain. Anything they're doing is about longer income streams, potentially from carbon, but also the other benefits that may well come.
Yeah, so there's a sort of two dimensions to this. There's the impact side, so how philanthropic you want to be in terms of actually what you're doing. And then there's the finance side. And different organisations or different investors will have different weightings on that. Some of them are sort of finance first, where they have a minimum impact threshold that they want to consider. Other ones are basically pure philanthropists, and actually they're not really interested about the profit that they're making, but they're mainly interested in the impact. And in between those two points, you've got a whole range of different types of investors that are impact-focused to a greater or lesser extent.
So this... The creation of that impact, is there evidence that the benefits exist for the companies who do this?
Yeah, so the way that often when we're doing these types of analysis, what we do is there's a whole market appraisal work looking at the opportunities within the sector, and there's usually some sort of investment hypothesis, like if we move into this type of, say, renewables sector, that there's a competitive advantage and that will generate returns. But then when we present it back in terms of like an investment prospectus, it's things like for every pound or dollar that's invested in this impact fund, it achieves a return on investment of X, but also generates the equivalent of Y, pounds of environmental and social benefit to society. And it's looking at that holistic piece of the societal benefits alongside the financial benefits, which is the focus of impact investing.
Yeah, and I think most of the things we mentioned, so both peatland or woodland code, for example, they've got audit approaches that underlie some of those things. And the biodiversity market we're seeing for land in the rest of the UK as well, what you're going to see with that is future habitat assessment to look at whether the benefits have been realised before any financial payment is made out. So I think the mechanisms are there. I don't know to what extent they're working and they're strong and they're helping achieve the objectives, but they're there in principle and in practice in the regulations. But obviously how it happens over years, we have to wait and see.
How sophisticated are people who are investing in rural land, in forestry and peat bogs and things like that?
I think we're seeing a change. A few years ago, we were seeing very speculative purchases. And I think that's why we ended up with some very, very high figures being achieved. As we're going through time, as with any market, as it develops, we're starting to see much more due diligence being done and buyers being much more careful as to what they're actually achieving. And that's why the piece that Tom does is so, so important to a lot of our clients, is working out as market value meets the ESG value or the impact investing value, will those two figures come together? Because at the moment, they're still quite far apart.
So what does this all look like from an urban perspective? Can you guys think of any examples where impact investing plays out and gives companies benefits?
Yeah, so in many ways, it's same, same, but different in the actual processes that we go through in thinking about the opportunities and the way to communicate them. It's very similar. But obviously, the medium in which you're practicing those skills is different. So within the urban space, there's often a greater social element because there's more people involved. Often the level of impact you have actually is associated with the starting position. So taking something that is marginal or underperforming and then having lots of very capable people have improvement strategies, come up to get pull together a really good plan and then actually take that through that transformation, that's where you have the big impact. It impacts about change, taking something that's not so good or underperforming and actually making it better.
But also in terms of the ease here, what you're dealing with here is often people and buildings. They already have a data trail. The stuff already exists. When you're talking about the rural perspective, you're often trying to get data on the soil, as was mentioned, but perhaps data on biodiversity. This stuff all needs to be collected from ground up. So you've got some data to start with in the urban environment that makes the initial part easier. Whereas in the rural area, we're still even trying to build, or how do we collect this data, or what's needed to comply with the Peatland Carbon Code or the Woodland Carbon Code? How much data do we need to be able to do that? And how do we collect it? How do land managers collect that data? It's a real challenge. You can't underestimate that. And of course, satellites and things can help, but we're still starting that journey, really.
Okay, so I'm being naive in this area. I wonder how much human emotion has to play in this. I can imagine organisations wanting to have impact, being more interested in having impact on people because they can, makes them feel warm and cuddly, than on CO2, which doesn't make them feel anything.
So my response to that is it's impacts all social, really. So the reason we can concerned about greenhouse gas emissions, for example, is that will have an impact on society. And many of us care about the natural world, but often the lens in which that care manifests itself is in terms of the impact that it will have on people around in different places.
Some people really value the social impacts, and some people really value the environmental ones. When you're measuring it or trying to assess it, you're looking to be objective and try and make sure you get a way of comparing those different things and doing it objectively across all the different impacts and look at both social and environment. And, it is possible to get to a view on that, but people do vary between how they respond to these things, as you said.
Okay, so is there a business case for impact investing specifically? Like, what are the benefits of doing that as opposed to, say, just ESG investing or traditional investing models?
Yeah, so I think it depends on how you look at it. I approach this from two angles. One is that this sort of fundamental investment hypothesis. And to me, I think there's definitely a case we had that given the climate crisis and environmental breakdown, that businesses are focused on creating positive impact. There's going to be an area for them to develop into. The second thing is what's impacts investing's position within the market. And not everybody's going to be a ethical or an impact orientated investor, but there's definitely a subsection of people that when they're actually investing their money, they want to make sure that that money is achieving a return on investment, but also doing some good at the same time. That market's always been there, and I think it will always be there. And the evidence suggests that that market's growing rather than shrinking.
Isn't it growing because of the generational thing? Like, future investors are more sustainability conscious and therefore would be headed in that direction?
Yes, I think there is a bit of that it's generationally linked, but it's also linked to underlying things like the climate crisis and environmental breakdown, which are helping to drive that change in thinking.
But coming back to the regulations you mentioned, so particularly the European taxonomy, what you're looking at here is certain funds, Article 8 and Article 9 under that taxonomy, where investors, the people that have the money, are looking to put money into those funds. So the business case really comes from saying, look, we can create this impact and we can get our fund recognised as Article 9. And we think we can access a cheaper rate of capital because we've got this impact alongside the financial return. So that's part of the story about where the business case comes from. The second part, in particularly around assets, both urban and rural, is licence to operate. So where you're licensed to operate, to get hold of certain assets you want to get hold of requires you to demonstrate certain things, whether it's through planning or through the rural policy frameworks we're seeing in different parts of the UK change, where that gets you access to new assets for you to manage, then that is another part of that business case. There's two very solid underlying business case reasons why you might want to go down the impact investing route. And then there's all sorts of other funds where you're looking at very niche types of investment to appeal to certain people who've got certain types of money, looking for a certain specific return from it as well.
So overall, how optimistic or confident are you about the future of impact investing and its future health?
I mean, I'd say that the frameworks are there. The scaffolding we talked about is there to look at investments in different things in a different way. And from that point of view, I'm really enthusiastic about it. I think there's a lot of mileage here. It's about applying capital and money to places where you can really try and improve the world. It's definitely got a lot going for it in terms of where we've started from. I think some of the reality is going to hit around the data. Can we gather the data? Can we report this properly? Can we actually demonstrate the improvements that are being said? And I think some of it can, but in the longer run, is going to come out. Can we get back and audit some of the stuff and actually prove these differences have been made to avoid it being accused of being greenwashing? And I think I'm just a little bit more skeptical that we've got to that stage yet. There's a lot of great stories out there, but I don't think we're seeing situations where you can really point to that and say, that's fantastic, it's all good. There's an element of data and work, I think, needed to prove that these things are really working.
Sarah, what about you? Are you a bit more positive than Henry was being there?
I am. I'm really positive because land is a critical and finite resource. And in the current market, having these new investors coming in and changing the way of traditional land management is really, really exciting for me working in property.
I just think the positive is all on the upside, really, because one, we actually just need impact investing. The climate crisis, environmental breakdown, a lot of social issues, they're not going to go away. They're there and we need to respond to them. And with impact investing, it creates a discipline and a harmony. It's a combination of the two, which is really nice to work in a sense that on the one hand, that you're having to find this sort of sweet spot between having a financial impact and then having the positive environmental social impact. But two, has the harmony of actually doing good at the same time. And that's a really nice way to be working.
Well, now it's just about the right time for Tell Us Something We Don't Know.
Yeah, just a little nugget of something, a little sort of bit of information that we might know nothing about that sort of shines a bit more of a light on the situation. Tom, let's start with you. Tell us something we don't know.
My observation is that if you look at the UK economy as a whole, growth has been slightly anemic for the last few years, except for if you look at net zero. The net zero sector has been growing about 9% over the last year or so. And that, I think, shows the type of interest in this area and why impact investing is somewhere to look at.
Hello, Henry, what's yours?
So here's something, having worked in this sector quite a long time now, this is the thing that really surprises me every time I put it into a spreadsheet and do a bit of analysis on it. But the carbon footprint of electricity in the UK over my career is now one third what it used to be. And although we can be pessimistic about some of the stuff around environment, that's a good news story. And so that's part of the thing that drives me. There's optimism in the way we've done that. And I think we can apply it more widely to other stuff in society.
That's great. I'm going to go home happy now. Sarah, tell us something we don't know.
Well, mine is a bit of a plug to plant some more trees. So did you know that the amount of oxygen produced by an acre of trees, an acre is a big area, equals the amount consumed by 18 people in a year?
Really?
We need to plant more trees.
We need to plant more. We need to plant a lot more trees. Well, listen, thank you all very much for that. I think I've learnt rather a lot today, Mary-Liz.
So have I. Thanks, everyone. That was really fascinating.
And so that's it for our fourth episode. One more to go in this series. What are we going to be talking about next time?
Well, we'd like to end the series out with a bang. So I think this next one is going to be about looking at the future of policy and looking at what good looks like going forward.
Great. Well, I think that'll be a great way to end the series. Thank you all very much again for being here today. Mary-Liz, we'll see you next. We'll see each other next time. And thank you very much for listening. And goodbye for now.
Goodbye.
This podcast is for general information only and should not be considered professional advice. Savills accepts no liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss arising from the use of, reference to, or reliance on this podcast or its content. Savills makes no warranty as to the accuracy of the information in this podcast. This podcast and all copyright in this podcast is the property of Savills, and it shall not be used, reproduced, or quoted in whole or in part without Savills' prior written consent.